It's amazing to meet you. It is simply extraordinary.
Good for you. Good for you. And yet, it is true. What do we call you, sir?
Hello, I'm Sam Adams, and this is the Slate spoiler special for Glass. Glass is the third film in a trilogy that began with M. Night Shyamalan's Unbreakable in 2000 and picked up again in 2016's Split. The premise of all three movies is that comic book-like superheroes live among us and have for centuries, but they keep a low profile and sometimes don't even know that they have powers themselves. In Glass, Samuel L. Jackson's evil mastermind resumes his quest to make their existence public by engineering a battle between Bruce Willis and James McAvoy, which leads to a climactic showdown that, well, we'll get to that. Joining me to talk about Glass is Jeffrey Bloomer, who is the senior editor at Slate.
Hi, Sam.
And Matt Singer, who is the editor-in-chief of Screen Crush.
Hi.
Hi. So let's sort of set the groundwork here, because I think we all have some sort of history with M. Night Shyamalan. He's been around a long time. And this is the way this movie kind of came to be part of a trilogy is quite unusual. Both Unbreakable and Split kind of saved as for the last act twist that they were actually comic book movies. You know, Unbreakable kind of presents itself as this sort of fairly realistic, grounded thing about this security guard played by Bruce Willis discovering that he's kind of impervious. And then you only find out at the big twist at the end, because every Shyamalan movie has to have a twist, that Samuel L. Jackson's character, who like runs an art gallery specializing in sequential art, as he would probably call it, is this kind of evil genius who's been masterminding Bruce Willis's emergence as the superhero all along. Split is a movie in which James McAvoy plays a character, kind of a sort of serial killer with multiple personalities, one of which he's convinced, we think delusionally, is this kind of superhuman persona called the Beast. And we only find out at the end of the movie that the Beast is, in essence, real, that he actually does become kind of bulletproof when this persona takes control. And then we find out at the very end, in the literal last shot of the movie, is a shot of Bruce Willis's character sitting at the counter of a diner, kind of hearing a news report about James McAvoy. And that it is only at that point that we realize that this whole movie has kind of been taking place in the same universe as Unbreakable and was, in fact, a sequel that no one knew was a sequel until that point. So the big difference with this movie is that we know where we are at the beginning. We know that we're already in this comic book world where there are both heroes and villains. And that puts us on an entirely different sort of footing. So, I mean, what was your feeling kind of going into this?
I was sort of looking forward to it, I have to tell you. I mean, I think Unbreakable is one of the good Shyamalans. You know, I thought that the twist at the end of Split was reasonably clever, you know, to kind of, as twists go, compared to the twists in Glass, which we'll talk about. I mean, it was pretty good that these were all like sort of the Shyamalan cinematic universe, I guess, that they were all connected. So, you know, going into it, I was sort of looking forward to it. What I got was not what I expected, both in terms of sort of the content and how much of the movie is, you know, not really, it's not really like superheroes being superheroes. It's more like superhero therapy, or a woman sort of trying to gaslight superheroes into thinking that they're not superheroes. And then just the fact that I was kind of interested to see it, and then I thought it was kind of a huge disappointment.
Jeff?
I was not particularly looking forward to it. See, the thing is, for me, it looked like it indulged all of Shyamalan's worst instincts about leaning into his own like neuroses with the different movies. And also, I think it's sort of fraudulent to playing into his hands to call it a trilogy, because Split, the movie, until the last 5 or 10 minutes, has absolutely no signs that it's part of this.
No pun intended.
What?
Ha, signs. But no, there's no sign that it's, I did it again, that it's part of this sort of interconnected world. It just feels very tacked on to a point where I'm like shocked that a Universal executive didn't say no. Like, you're not doing this. I'm not letting you do this. Instead, it just draws into this world and this movie. They're tonally so different that I was really worried that they were not, like they were going to clash in a bad way as one movie. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. I mean, I think going in, I was kind of excited despite myself. I have a pretty sort of checkered history with his whole over, I guess. I was a film critic at one of the alt weeklies in Philadelphia when The Sixth Sense came out. And I think, as most people probably know, M. Night Shyamalan is from Philadelphia, still lives on the Main Line. It was a huge deal in Philadelphia that a filmmaker like actually became successful like while living there, because usually people are raised there and then go somewhere else and become famous and occasionally, you know, make a sort of terrible rap song about it. But, you know, he stuck there. People were really excited. I panned the movie before realizing that it was being a come this and say thing. I got hate mail about that review for like literally 3 years afterwards.
Wow, do you still hate it?
I mean, I haven't seen it since then. I don't see any reason to change. I mean, I liked the ones after that better. Like, I kind of liked Unbreakable. I thought Signs was kind of interesting. I like The Village in some ways quite a lot. And then things have kind of gone downhill since then. So another thing that's going on with this movie is Shyamalan has been having a little bit of a resurgence recently, starting with The Visit in, I guess, 2015. And this seemed, the sort of twist at the end of Splits very much seemed like, I mean, a very calculated move to kind of both kind of put himself back in the conversation and to kind of muscle his way into what's become this sort of enormous superhero monoculture. And one of the things that's so different about this movie coming out now and Unbreakable in 2000 Unbreakable was kind of in this real kind of trough for superhero movies. I mean, the Batman franchise had fizzled out at that point. It was 4 years before the first of Sam Raimi's Spider-Man movies. So it was really kind of a nothing period for the genre. And it's almost hard to imagine it, but it was actually a surprise to get to the end of this movie and be like, wait a minute, we've been watching like superhero movie. Like, all along, it was actually kind of like a neat, you know, twist that sort of like cast the whole movie in a different light. That's not the environment we're in now. I mean, it's the least surprising thing a movie can be about is superheroes at this point. I was like, oh, it could be very like interesting to see him like take on this genre that's changed so much, and maybe some of the ideas in that, like, to see, you know, how the ideas in the first movie will have shifted since the cultural terrain shifted so much. I think we'll talk about this, but I think largely the ideas have not.
Yeah.
And that is one of the huge problems with this movie. You know, we try to sort of, in the spoiler specials, take people through the plot if they're having trouble with it or just haven't seen the movie. It's weird with this movie because I feel like on the one hand, a lot, and on the other hand, like very little happens. The movie felt, when I was watching it, about 9 hours long. You know, then I try to come back on it and think about, you know, exactly what happened. And I kind of can't remember that many actual plot points. But just in brief, kind of we pick up 19 years after Unbreakable, although somehow also only a few weeks after Split, which was set 16 years after it. So,
right.
They're very explicit about how long it's been since the first movie in both of them. So I'm not sure how that works. But Bruce Willis's character, David Dunn, he's gone from being a security guard to running kind of a security store. He is with his son, who's played by Spencer Treat Clark, who also played his son in Unbreakable. He's still kind of a vigilante crime fighter, but he seems to, you know, in a very small stakes sense. I mean, the opening scene of the opening scene of the movie is actually involves James McAvoy's character. But the first time we see Bruce Willis in this movie, he is tracking down these kind of punk kids who were like shooting like a kind of would be viral video and like punched a guy. And he goes and like tracks them down. So his ambitions, despite being, you know, sort of Superman-ish, or at least, you know, Power Man-ish or something. I mean, has really not sort of gotten especially ambitious about his crime fighting in the intervening 19 years. He didn't like go and track down Osama bin Laden or something. But he's, you know, stayed very much under the radar. He's kind of a shadowy figure in Philadelphia. He's been given various names over the years.
The Tiptoe Man.
The Tiptoe Man is one of the, like, who came up with that?
Yeah.
The Green Ghost, I think.
Overseer.
The Overseer is the one they seem to settle on.
Yeah, they have most recently settled on the Overseer, which is some sort of an improvement. But anyway, he gets wind that this James McAvoy character, Kevin Wendell Crumb, also known as the Beast or the Horde.
The Horde.
Yes. Yes, I saw one article that it might have been yours, Beth, that referred to them as like Horde Dunn and Glass, which actually sounds like a law firm. But so the Horde is sort of still out there. He's got a thing for kidnapping cheerleaders, chaining them up, and then eating them. And he's done this again. Bruce Willis kind of happens to bump into him in the street, and he has this sort of psychic. I'm trying not to say sixth sense. It's hard. But
it's his overseer sense. Yes. But he has to actually touch the people, which is not at all creepy.
No, yes.
That so, he touches people and then he can sort of glom their deepest, darkest, evil secrets.
Yeah. So he realizes that, that James McAvoy is this Beast character, that he has these women kind of chained up in a warehouse somewhere. He tracks him down. Fights it, rescues them. But just as he's kind of about to be triumphant, up shows Sarah Paulson, who plays a sort of psychiatrist, I guess, specializing in kind of superhero delusion. That's her line. She is believes that there are people out there who believe that they are superheroes but are wrong. And rather than having them go to jail, or she has 3 days to convince them that, in fact, they're not who they think they are. So then both Bruce Willis and James McAvoy get locked up in the same asylum that also happens to where Samuel Jackson's character from the first movie has been locked up for 19 years. And that's sort of, I guess, the first hour, but also sort of the first act of the movie. I mean, was there sort of a point in there, Matt, where you kind of felt like things were maybe going off the rails, or how long were you with it?
I was with most of what you're describing. I mean, the tiptoe man might have, or whatever he's called, might have raised my eyebrows. But no, I mean, I thought that was like the strongest stuff in the movie, because I didn't realize that Spencer Tweet Clark was going to be back playing his son. And I thought that was kind of an interesting dynamic, that he's kind of his, like, Alfred is his son who sits in his kind of like bat cave, his overseer cave underneath their business. And they talk on the phone and he helps him fight crimes. I don't know. I thought that was sort of, kind of a believable kind of place to find this character 19 years later, given that he was kind of a reluctant, shy character. It was really the part that really started to lose me was where we've left off the plot, where, this movie that seems like it's just kind of ramping up into this sort of conflict between the characters. Instead, they literally get thrown in jail. And then the next hour, or as you were saying, it feels like a 9-hour movie. So I guess the next like 6.5 hours is like sitting in rooms while Sarah Paulson as Dr. Ellie Staple, is her character's name, as she kind of tries to convince them that they are all not superheroes. And I'm sure we'll talk about that part. But I thought not only was that part sort of very long and plotting and talky and boring, like it just seems fundamentally from a conceptual level, it seems misguided to me to do that in this movie after you've done Unbreakable and Split, movies about these breaking down the audience's natural kind of defense to believing that superheroes could be real. Like that was the idea behind Unbreakable. That was the idea almost behind Split, which you didn't even realize. It was like this guy he's James McAvoy character. He's crazy. He thinks he's got the beast inside him. And then at the end, oh, my goodness, he does. And Unbreakable had the same thing. So you've spent like a combined like 3 hours convincing people superheroes are real. And then this movie spends the middle hour of its movie like, actually, they're not real. And it's just like, it seems so fundamentally misguided to me to do that in this movie.
Yeah, I totally agree with you about the beginning. It was like very fun kind of at first. I was sad that Robin Wright just was like unceremoniously killed off with cancer, because I was expecting her to show up at some point.
Yep.
She was the wife in Unbreakable. But that dynamic was great. And it was, I think it pointed to the kind of movie that we were cheated out of, mm-hmm. which is an actual sequel to Unbreakable, which it seems like may have been viable. But then once we get into the asylum, it very quickly becomes untenable.
Yeah, I mean, I have sort of mixed and sort of not entirely informed, because there's just way too much to talk about. But I have complicated feelings about Ryan Murphy. But I think the greatest thing, the most unequivocally great thing about Ryan Murphy is that he's like made Sarah Paulson like a star finally, and that's like very exciting, and it's great to see her. It's great to see her in this big role and this kind of starring position in this movie. But her character just kind of doesn't make any sense. I mean, she seems to be, at least for most of the movie, and we'll get to the twist, or one of them, but she seems to be kind of acting in good faith. I mean, she really believes these people are delusional, although that also requires her to be kind of extremely stupid somehow, which is a bit of a problem considering that she's supposed to be playing this kind of high-level psychiatrist. But, you know, it just puts her in the position of spending this huge chunk of the movie trying to convince these people that something that we know is true
right. Is
not true. And it seems like Shyamalan, like the movie is trying to kind of make us question whether or not that's true, or sort of being built on like, oh, what if it's not? But it's like, we know this already. Like there's no more question. And it's like, he can't sort of skip past that part that he's already, as you say, Matt, like already spent two like entire movies establishing. So, you know, this movie takes, I think it's an hour and 15 minutes before Samuel L. Jackson has his first line. Like he spends, you know, more than half of the movie kind of just sedated, kind of drooling and occasionally like twitching one of his eyes, because supposedly he's so dangerous that you can't even let him, you know, form a coherent thought or something, despite the fact that he has these incredibly brittle bones that if he like basically
sneezes,
brushes up against something the wrong way, he'll like shatter into a million pieces. You know, it just takes so long to get to where it feels like the movie ought to start.
Yeah, and I mean, Unbreakable and Split, like the twists at the end, you could say, well, like they sometimes seem kind of misguided, but they don't really harm the rest of the movie. Like the rest of the movies are kind of about the characters and about their feelings about what's going on and the, you know, whatever they are. This movie, the whole movie is building to this big shocking twist that to me like actively undermines the rest of the movie, because especially like you're talking about Sarah Paulson's character, like we don't get to see her, anything about her except where she's like monologuing and explaining to these people how they're not actually superheroes. We never get to see why she's doing it, what she thinks about it, what her life outside of this bizarre asylum is, because to show any of those things would spoil the big plot twist that he has planned. And so he's created a movie where the character who talks the most and has the most dialogue and is like driving the story is someone we know nothing about, don't understand, don't really care about. And again, it's just like – it's like from a structural, conceptual perspective, it's so bizarre because like you said, like the movie is called Glass, but Sam Jackson doesn't talk for an hour and 15 minutes. And, you know, it's like it's barely about him. They almost should have called it Staple, except we don't know what her deal is, because to do so would be to spoil the big twist, which – you know, maybe if the twist was really, truly mind-blowing and interesting and exciting, you could almost justify it in your mind. But to me, it was not. And so it became the thing where it was like, what a colossal waste of time that was.
All right. Well, let me run us through sort of the next section of the plot, kind of just up to the twist. And we'll talk about that a little bit, because I think we're going to spend, you know, a lot of the time talking about, and this is that's an M. Night Shyamalan movie. That's why we're here. We know what's coming. So eventually what happens is, of course, Samuel L. Jackson, Mr. Glass, as first name Mr., last name Glass.
Yes.
As he prefers
he
to be
He says
called.
That.
Yes.
That's a line of dialogue in the film.
Yeah, it's really, yes. I don't want to, Jeff wrote a great post for the site kind of going through the ending. And I think there's like, I've gotten to the twist yet, but there's all these parts where you're like, but how do you know this is happening? Like, because here is the line of dialogue that says this is what's happening right now while you're watching the movie. You know, for me, it felt a little bit like, you know, Samuel L. Jackson's character is kind of like having like a, you know, someone explaining the plot, like sitting in the next seat to you the entire time. He just keeps telling you like what's happening in comic book terms, as if we haven't all been completely spent the last 15 years just being completely deluged
right. With
comic book logic. Like, we don't need a character in the movie to explain that in comic books, often the bad guy and the good guy fight each other at
they
the climax.
Showdown. Like, yes. He almost uses air quotes to say it every time.
Yes. But so in any case, we find out that he has once again this insanely kind of complicated plot that you really cannot look at too closely, where he has been pretending to be sedated the whole time, but is really just kind of lying in wait. Once he realizes that the Horde and the Green Ghost, or the Tiptoe Man and the Beast, or whoever it is you want to call them, once he realizes that they're all in the same asylum, he wants to arrange this big battle between these two characters. He wants it to happen publicly. He says he wants it to happen at the top of the Osaka Tower, which is a newly opened structure in Philadelphia, which does not actually exist, but is going to be the sort of the tallest building in the city because often in superhero comics, people go to the site of some great human achievement. And so it's just going to open. They're going to be all those cameras there. These two guys are going to go and have this big public fight. And then it will be clear once and for all to the world that superheroes or whatever you want to call these creatures, these sort of next evolution of humanity, that they actually exist, which is kind of Glass's like whole agenda. He wants people to realize that the things we have taken to be kind of, you know, silly myths or fantasies are actually real, that comic books have always been kind of a way of just kind of coping with or rationalizing or kind of passing down this knowledge without really admitting what's actually going on. So he wants to organize this big battle. His plans do not go as we think he has planned, or the budget didn't come through or something. So instead of fighting on the top of the giant skyscraper, they end up fighting in the parking lot of the of the mental asylum. We have to talk about Anya Taylor-Joy's character as well, but who is sort of James McAvoy's intended victim in Split, the only person to kind of escape. For some reason, despite the fact that he tried to eat her in the previous movie, she kind of feels sorry for him. In this one, Samuel Jackson's mother, played by Charlene Woodard, shows up again. So and Bruce Willis's son, Spencer Tree Clark, is there. So all three of them are present at this final battle, in which all three of these characters end up dead. We find out, I guess twist number one is we find out that, what is it, James McAvoy's dad?
His father died on the same train crash that was when Bruce Willis discovered his powers, which was all engineered by Samuel Jackson. He caused it to crash because he was trying to find superheroes, trying to prove they existed.
Yes.
There's so many fucking twists in this movie that I forgot about that point completely.
I thought we already knew that. For some reason, I don't know why, but I just like almost assumed that was the case. I don't know why I did. I guess I had heard that they were calling these movies like the Eastrail 177 trilogy or something, which is the name of the train that crashed. Yes. And so I just connected in my mind. I was like, oh, right, because that's where Bruce Willis was. And clearly that must have inspired James McAvoy somehow. Yes. And that turns out to be the twist.
Yeah. So when McAvoy finds this out, he kills Samuel L. Jackson. He kind of crushes his brittle bones in his chest so that he slowly bleeds out in the parking lot, but not before he can witness the rest of the fight. Anya Taylor-Joy has this kind of tender moment with James McAvoy where she gets his kind of least aggressive, kind of truest personality, which is kind of this abused child. His story and the story of Split really is that both of them were abused as children. She has been kind of recuperating from it in a more healthy manner. He dealt with it by having his personality fractured into these 25 different personalities. The most benign of them is Kevin, who is this kid. So she kind of gets this, talks to him, gets the beast to go back inside him, gets this kid to take control again. And they have a tender kind of moment in each other's arms. And right at that moment, one of the police snipers, who we think is just there to watch things, shoots him dead. And meanwhile, Bruce Willis's character, because this is a comic book movie and everything is super dramatic, is, I think the phrase is drowned in a puddle.
Correct.
Yes.
Yes.
Superman, the equivalent of Superman, drowns in a puddle.
Yes. We do know from the first movie that his weakness is water, but
water
is
his
still
kryptonite.
Kind of insanely anticlimactic. So before we get to the big twist, I mean, what do we make of this scene? I mean, you can be of two minds about it. On the one hand, there is a certain kind of, when are we going to get to the fireworks factory? Because they keep telling you that you're going to be up on this big skyscraper. And I'm like, we've been here for like over 2 hours. Like, I don't want another like 20-minute skyscraper battle here. This doesn't feel like a very big budget movie. Like, I'm not even sure how, you know. So there's a weird letdown, but it's also, I mean, you can look at it as like kind of a subversion or something. Like, Matt, I think you wrote about this somewhat, just about how kind of physically absent Bruce Willis is in particular in this scene. I mean, it just seems like 98% of it was done with body doubles, including his death scene. There's no, like, you don't see his face. There's some emotional component to James McAvoy and Samuel Jackson dying, but he just unceremoniously gets like his head dunked in a puddle until he dies.
Yeah.
So
literally.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm still blown away by that.
I think that it does bear like the unmistakable scars of the budget, though. Apparently Shyamalan financed this movie himself, which goes a long way to explaining why anybody wanted to make it. Like Universal just paid for it in the US and then Disney was going to release it overseas or something. But I around halfway through realized we were never going to make it to the tower. And I was like, okay, this is it. This is the movie.
I mean, I think, you know, calling it sort of subversive to set that up and then kind of undercut it. I think in a better movie that might be possible. I mean, certainly he is riffing on the idea that all of these Marvel movies end with a big skyscraper and a laser beam shooting into the sky from the top of it. And it's sort of playing with our expectations. But, you know, Sam, you also talked about how this movie seems sort of locked in like the 20 years ago concept of superheroes. So that's the thing. It's like it doesn't have any sort of additional insights into what's happened. And as I've been sitting here listening to you, you know, like I had the same problem about the fact that it doesn't, you know, the ideas that were interesting and unbreakable, they don't seem to have like evolved at all here. And I was trying to like almost like play devil's advocate and like justify it in my mind. And I'm like, well, okay, Samuel Jackson's character has been locked up for 19 years. So maybe he doesn't understand that comic book movies have evolved and the world has changed. Which could have been interesting if anyone else in the movie who has spent time on the outside could talk to him about that, ever pointed out, hey, we know superhero movies are huge now. Everyone talks about superheroes. We all know. You don't have to explain it to us anymore. We get it, Mr. Glass.
Yeah, Sarah Paulson's character, Dr. Ellie Staple, I feel like we have to say. I mean, she has this line where she's kind of explaining how this all works to Spencer Street Clark and Charlene Wooder and she and Anya Taylor-Joy, and she's like, have you ever been to a comic book convention? And it's like, you don't need the whole world the comic book convention at this point. You don't need to go to understand this stuff now.
Right, exactly. And so and even like almost more essential than that, you know, Glass in the first movie, and I rewatched it last week, and part of what I found really interesting is that he very much has sort of the attitude of like what we now associate as kind of the ultimate kind of online fanboy who demands superheroes are serious. They are real to me, darn it. And I want you to treat them with the seriousness that they deserve. He has a scene in Unbreakable where he's like, he has his art gallery and someone comes in wanting to buy artwork. He's like, my son is going to love it. He's 4 years old. He's like, what? This is art, sir. Good day. And he will not sell him his art because this is a serious thing. This is not for children. And it just seems like, again, like that concept had a lot of like you could see someone believing that in 1999 and the year 2000. But in 2019, it's like the fanboys have won. Yeah. And the seriousness that they wanted, they got. Like everyone cares now. Everyone, this is everything. This is our whole world. So again, to sort of not address that, not include that, not evolve the ideas in the movie as a result, it's just sort of just. I'm just so frustrated because, again, like I do like Unbreakable a lot, and I revisiting it, I was like, I really like this movie a lot, and I'm just so frustrated that really none of the sort of good stuff in there wound up here, up to and including like Bruce Willis not being present in that final fight at all. I mean, I guess it's very convenient. His costume as a superhero is literally just like a poncho,
right,
which covers his head, which makes it very easy to double him in action scenes where we're just seeing the back of a poncho.
Yeah.
But again, like when his character is literally drowned in a puddle, even though there's a giant water tank behind him, they could have drowned him in.
Yeah.
Like that would have made a lot more sense. We don't really see his face. We don't get anything from that. Nothing emotionally.
And I love that there's a shot before that of just like the big kind of pothole in the parking lot. It's just like, oh my gosh, is that a pothole? What if it were to become filled with water? What will become of our hero?
So one thing I didn't understand was, were the police like in cahoots with the superhero Illuminati, or were they working for the superhero?
Yeah. So let me lay out this twist for those of you who have not seen the movie or saw it and could not fucking believe your eyes. So after the sniper shoots Kevin Crumb, James McAvoy, right before he sort of fires the fatal shot, we see that his sleeve is pulled back a little bit on his wrist, and there is, I guess it's like a clover tattoo, right?
Like it's like a four leaf clover.
Yeah. So there's a clover tattoo on his wrist. Then as Samuel Jackson is dying, Sarah Paulson, Dr. Ellie Staple, comes up to him and says something, I'm not going to remember, but it basically like, I'm so sorry. Like, I tried. They gave me 3 days. They said if I could just convince you to sort of step down, if I could talk you out of thinking that you're superheroes, you could have gone on your way. But now we have to do this. And then there's a flashback, or sort of sideways or whatever. And we see her as being part of this kind of secret group gathered in this fancy restaurant. And we sort of realize that she is part of, yes, this sort of anti-superhero Illuminati Hellfire Club, something or other, the sort of secret society of people whose job it is, for some reason, to keep the existence of superheroes and villains, I guess, whatever, metahumans.
Metahumans.
Yes, we'll say metahumans.
metahumans.
Yes. Oh, boy. Whose kind of task it is to just keep them secret. So what they've been doing all along, traditionally old-fashioned way, is they just kill them. Sarah Paulson has been sort of pioneering this more humane treatment where she just gaslights them until they start thinking that they're not super anymore. And so this has been her experimental treatment that she's been trying. It has failed in this case. And so therefore they all had to die. So...
yes, the scene, there's like a later scene where she goes into a restaurant. Everybody is like very eerie and turns toward her just like in silence.
Well, they're all, it's like they're going about their meals. And then like the one person who's not in the Illuminati leaves. And then all of a sudden it's silence and they all turn.
And what I love is it's not just like, and I believe the restaurant in that shot is High Street on Market. But I'm not 100% sure.
Is it an evil restaurant?
In real life
experience?
Their bread's very good. But no, when the one person walks out the door and then it falls silent, the people still in there include like the servers,
the bartender. There's a very clear shot of the bartender listening, like
with a tattoo. Yeah,
yes, it's an evil bartender whose job it is to tend bar and ensure that superheroes don't realize they're real.
I wanted to like, what does this guy do? Like the other 98% of the time,
yes.
He's just like.
I wanted to know that too. I thought maybe it was like a communist club where they all switch roles. So maybe Sarah Paulson in the next movie will be a bartender, and then someone else will be. I wasn't sure, but
he also like invented the absinthe rinse. Like he's got a whole sideline going on there. But yeah, so.
Back to your question about like, do the police work for her?
Yeah,
I assumed with no evidence, just assuming. These were not actual police. They were the evil thugs of the Illuminati who were disguised as police to further their goals.
Yeah,
or maybe it's just even like the one. Oh no, I guess it's not the one guy because it's also two of them who like
at least two of them like don't they?
They drown Bruce Willis.
Puddle drown Bruce Willis.
And presumably if the other ones were real cops, they would
notice that their brethren were killing people in puddles.
Whatever your opinion of modern policing, probably someone at some point would step in and say, hey, maybe don't drown that guy in a puddle. Right. While there are a million security cameras.
Everyone seems to be in on it.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess that's right.
Yes. So twist number, we're up to that point. And then twist number three-ish. Four, whatever, we're up to that. Okay, so Dr. Ellie Staple believes that she has, done her regrettable duty and killed these people and goes back to the asylum to delete all the security camera footage because there's a whole sequence earlier where you see them putting up all these cameras to keep an eye on Samuel Jackson's character. And she realizes that at this point, and I think the movie is at least sort of successful in having had enough sort of busyness to make you forget that there was a stray shot earlier where you saw Samuel Jackson kind of go into this security camera room and like type a bunch of computer code and then it just cut away. And it, I think it makes you think it has something to do with the big building that they're going to that they never end up at. But anyway, she goes to delete the security footage. It's all deleted. Everything's fine. And then she kind of says, hey, wait a minute. Has anyone else accessed this footage? And that's when you realize that in this whole thing was a big setup and that in fact, Mr. Glass, the ultimate mastermind, was playing like ninth dimensional chess and in fact had arranged for them all to get murdered in a parking lot in full view of security cameras so that he could then stream the security camera footage offsite and had sent to the three people we mentioned before, kind of one for each of them, Bruce Willis's son and James McAvoy's victim and Samuel Jackson's mother. And so they all get copies of the footage and they kind of, in the last secret scene of the movie, they decide collectively to upload it to the web to sort of foil these people's plans and let the world know what the truth is. And then they just kind of sit in 30th Street Station. I think it's around gate 5. and just wait for people's screens to start to light up and the truth to spread around. And then I think Charlene Woodard has a line like, this is the beginning of a new universe or something like that. It was a little...
Something like that, yes.
And seed.
I think that's the last, line. And then the camera pulls back and people are like, are you seeing this on your phone? Are you seeing this?
Yeah.
And then there's, I think the last thing you see is like, that it's been picked up on like CNN or something like
yes.
that.
Yes. Yes. And in my theater, everybody got up immediately and tried to leave because we had been there for a while. But then all of us are like, fuck, actually, there's probably going to be an after credit scene setting up some kind of. And we all stood there waiting for the screen. And then there was nothing.
The biggest twist
then
of all.
We all filed out.
Yes.
No post credits scenes.
Oh, man. Yeah. That scene was actually kind of elegantly staged, I thought. But like, it's just at that point, it's just so, so bad.
Well, yeah. And it's, I mean, there is like, Matt, you mentioned going back and watching Unbreakable, which I did as well. And I had sort of forgotten because it's so fallen out of his filmmaking now that he was, I mean, like at that point that he was like, you know, just on a sort of formal level, like kind of an interesting or at least like different filmmaker. So Unbreakable is, it's a movie about superheroes, but it is, shot in these very long takes. And it starts with, there's probably, a, you know, a 3 or 4 or 5 minute scene that's almost the first thing in the movie, the first real scene of Bruce Willis's character kind of hitting on a woman next to him on the train. And the camera just kind of goes back and forth between the seats. So you see kind of one or the other. And it's an unbroken take and it's just dialogue. And it's just about like who this guy is. And you see him, you know, kind of hide his wedding ring in his pocket before he flirts with him and before he flirts with her. So you know that this is like, okay, this guy's like kind of a, like a, you know, schlump and he's kind of unhappily married. And the scene is probably some of the best, like he tends to be pretty bad, I think, at writing sentences that sound like they would have come out of people's mouths, but that's maybe some of the best dialogue he's ever written. Like it actually sounds kind of painfully, it's like a painfully accurate account of a married man unsuccessfully hitting on a woman on a train. And there's just none of that here.
There's a little bit. There's a couple of funny sequences, right? There's the orderlies make jokes that are kind of funny at times. You get a little bit of that flavor from him. And I should say that in general, I'm also a defender. Like, I like most of his, maybe not most, at least half of his movies. But here, I agree that that stuff is muted. The other thing that I think he imported were just moments that are suddenly very cruel and disturbing. Like the scene where the other orderly threatens to drop his flashlight onto Mr. Glass, and that's like a genuinely tense, disturbing moment. There's the teacup scene. Is that in the original Unbreakable where young Mr. Glass is like getting broken because he's on the teacups?
No.
See, and that scene is like pretty effective, and like it just reminded me that he's capable of doing these kind of jolts of anxiety that genuinely are tense and disturbing. But for the most of the movie, it's all of his worst instincts.
There are flashbacks to his childhood in Unbreakable, but not that specific one.
That was like pretty
was an effective one. Yeah, I think that the sort of formally interesting stuff you're talking about in Unbreakable, which I agree with, and like, you know, it's cutesy, but the fact that Unbreakable, he's unbreakable, the takes are unbroken, I think is kind of actually clever.
Yeah.
I think the reason that they're not very much present in here in Glass is, again, budget. I just don't, I think that kind of like super granular filmmaking is probably, you just can't afford to make it that complicated when you're shooting on a tight budget and a schedule and all that stuff.
I mean, there's only a very small handful of shots in which you actually see one of them. You will recognize because it's like the only scene in the movie where the three kind of stars are sitting together. There are very few shots where all three of his lead actors are kind of interacting in the same frame. And that feels like very much a function of budget. And it does kind of cripple the movie somewhat, I think.
Yeah. So that last scene is a little flash of that long take stuff that you're talking about. But on the other hand, I was sitting there going, so we have the mother of this evil super genius who killed all of these people, including Kevin Wendell Crumb's father, and turned him into this monster that Anya Taylor-Joy, like tortured Anya Taylor-Joy.
Yeah.
And kind of essentially like doomed Joseph's dad, Bruce Willis's son, and they're all like friends now?
Yes.
And we're treating this action of like an out and out like supervillain who like owns his supervillain, like relishes being like a supervillain. Like it's like treated as like the music is like inspirational and twinkly and uplifting.
Yeah.
And it just seemed very like I thought it was a very strange sort of sequence of events and tone to that ending where it's like, yes, it's a wonderful ending where these people have been murdered and the survivors are now all friends, even though seemingly they would probably want, like, I don't think if I was like Bruce Willis's son, I don't know that I'd want to hang out with these people, even in this unlikely scenario.
Right. Well, and they haven't built up kind of the villains like the, you know, the Illuminati or whatever. They haven't built them up as enough of an antagonist to make just foiling their plans kind of dramatically satisfying. Right. So it's just the ending is supposed to be like, wow, imagine if, like, what if the world knew superheroes were real? And I'm like, you mean at the end of like Spider-Man 2 or the end of like how many movies, how many comic book stories have you know, been premised on that same plot? It's like, that's not an interesting, like, twist anymore. We've been through a million variations of that, and just to have that be so, like, kind of flatly presented feels like another indication, like, he just really, like, Shyamalan's just kind of been living in a bubble, and he is not, like, making a movie for this climate at this point.
Yeah, and I can't get over the tattoos.
The tattoos are so bad.
Are they all Irish? That was the thing that I was like, is why were they clover?
It's true. Sarah Paulson does have like very red hair in this, which is like a Shyamalan thing. He always makes the villains red. He's like a very literal kind of guy. But I guess, I don't know, maybe they are supposed to be Irish.
I mean,
yes.
Yeah. That would be another twist.
Never trust the Irish, I think, is the lesson.
They hate superheroes.
Yes.
As the Irish well documented. Bad in Philadelphia.
Yeah, St. Patrick was the first. He didn't actually drive the patron saint of destroying superheroes. Yeah, he didn't drive out the snakes. It was actually superheroes that he drove out of Ireland.
Oh, and I do have to say, I do kind of love any movie where like a secret society has very visible markers of their secret society. It's like that movie The Skulls, where they all had skulls tattooed on their wrists, but they covered them with watches.
Yes.
So no one could ever know.
Yeah, they're like their tragic weakness is shaking hands.
Exactly.
With people.
No one will ever know unless they look at our wrists.
It's perfect. So let's talk, like, I sort of have alluded to this a couple of times, but I think it is worth talking, especially because this isn't something people have been able to talk about in their reviews thus far because it is sort of spoilery, but like what happens to Anya Taylor-Joy's character, who is Casey Cook. So in Split, had this sort of not entirely worked out, but, you know, vaguely interesting idea about kind of the legacy of abuse, of childhood abuse. And so both her character, who I think is kind of in an abusive situation, like basically like kind of right up until she gets kidnapped by Kevin Crumb. They've both come out of these abusive backgrounds. They've both kind of grown up, or she's still kind of a teenager in that movie, but they are kind of growing up as, you know, scarred by this, dealing with the trauma in different ways. Because the plot of Glass requires her to be this kind of proxy, or to kind of, you know, stand in, you know, champion for Kevin Crumb, she just because the script required, becomes kind of, you know, sympathetic to and sad for him and sort of defending him and is still like frightened of him in some ways, but really wants to just like get, you know, this kind of benign personality, Kevin, kind of back in the light. And, you know, considering that she has like literally seen him like physically eat other young women, you know, that's, and, you know, and another thing that happens in this movie too, Shyamalan has always been an extremely chaste filmmaker. There's like barely any kissing in his movies, let alone anything else. And in Split, and in this movie, even though there's only kind of one scene, like there really is these scenes where the Beast kind of kidnaps these, you know, kind of nubile teenagers in cheerleader outfits. There really is like kind of a leering quality to the way those scenes are shot, and even to the way like Anya Taylor-Joy is kind of costumed in this one. And it just really feels, it doesn't even feel like, you know, Shyamalan suddenly become like a dirty old man. It just feels very calculated to me. It's like, oh, this is what I have to do to kind of get audiences back in. Like, you know, it's not, it's fairly, you know, it's not like he's throwing in like pointless nude scenes or something like that, but there is something just kind of skeevy about the way those characters and those kind of young women are treated in this movie that really gets under my skin.
I thought it was pretty bizarre how – I mean the stuff in Split where, as you said, they're kind of kindred spirits in a strange way, I thought that was sort of interesting as a concept. But yeah, where it goes here where she almost is like falling in love with him, you know, it's like kind of Stockholm syndrome-y. I thought it was sort of bizarre. And, you know, like I think what he's trying to do is – you know, he has this sort of duality thing going on in Unbreakable where, you know, the whole idea of Mr. Glass, first name Mr., last name Glass, is that he believes because he is so weak physically, there must be someone at the opposite end of the spectrum. And so he finds Bruce Willis who is, and he's right. He finds Bruce Willis. And so I think there's almost supposed to be something like that going on with those two characters from Split, Casey and Kevin Wendell Crum, except Casey never quite like, she never gets to really become a superhero. She just is more of a kind of a plot device to sort of be the sympathetic person and to sort of to humanize his character and to repeatedly insist he's not all bad, even though he is a literal cheerleader eating monster. And I just don't think it. I can sort of see what I think I see what he was going for. But I don't think it quite works.
No, I totally agree. It's extremely lurid. And honestly, the bigger problem for me was that I just completely forgot about her character. But I was like, who is this person again? And why is she not dead? Why wasn't she eaten? And it took basically the entire movie to explain to me again who she was. But I want to ask you about something that you just said. The Illuminati says that they kill superheroes because there has to be balance. And if there's like a superhero, then there automatically is going to be a villain. Do you remember this?
Yes. Yeah.
Yep.
But who is the balance for Kevin Wendell Crum or whatever his name is?
Well, that's sort of what I was. Yeah.
Yeah.
What
but
I was,
is it her? But she's not like a superhero.
She's not a superhero. She never really gets there. Maybe in the next movie, we'll find out.
Yeah. Or it's kind of like Bruce Willis again, because they're sort of antagonists in this. But then Samuel Jackson doesn't have a balance. Yeah. They do say like people kind of emerge in pairs, you know, but yeah, it doesn't pay off. And I thought, I mean, because you're sitting there, you're watching the movie, you know there's going to be at least one twist.
Right.
So you're sitting there, and I thought for a while, like, oh, maybe Casey's going to turn out to be a superhero, which I thought would be because Anna Taylor-Joy is also in the New Mutants movie, which is coming out this year, I guess.
Right.
So I was like, how many superheroes is going to play? Is she going to play this year? But the number is still one because nothing happens with her. All she does is kind of, you know, and there are all these kind of close-ups of her. She has these big kind of almost like sort of inhuman eyes. She has in fact played kind of, you know, weird cyborgy, you know, inhuman characters in a number of other movies. She's got a good face for that. But all she really does in here is just kind of, you know, look sad and feel bad for him.
I agree. Although I will say in one nice note, the acting in the movie, pretty good. There's so many good actors and everybody is like pretty okay, especially Bruce Willis wisecracking. It was kind of fun. I don't know. I didn't mind him so much.
I think on a technical level, I sort of enjoy seeing James McAvoy play all these characters. You can see he's having a lot of fun doing it.
Yes, although it gets a bit tiresome at times.
It can get a little
times is he going to wear a dress or like hit on a male orderly to shock us? I was getting a little bit. I was like, all right. But generally speaking, I agree.
And Samuel L. Jackson, I think once he gets to talk, you know, he's good. He's good in that role. You know,
yeah.
He's good at the sort of chatty supervillain role. Like you believe him as this mastermind. But again, he doesn't say one word for the first half of the movie, over an hour. And it's just like, you know, that's another almost, you know, he himself is almost like a when are we going to get to the fireworks factory thing, because he's just sitting there in a wheelchair and you're just. Let him do something. It's Samuel L. Jackson. He's sitting right there. He could make this movie more fun, more interesting, more lively.
You got him here. And he's one of like the great, I mean, as, you know, Quentin Tarantino realized, you know, 25 years ago, he's like one of our great talkers.
Right.
You know, like if you just put a camera on him and have him say words, it will be interesting. Like his, I think one of his best performances in recent years is he did the voiceover narration for a documentary called I Am Not Your Negro about James Baldwin. And that was amazing. Like just him in front of a microphone is an incredible thing. Just having him like kind of drool and twitch for like almost an hour and a half is does not seem like the best use of your Samuel Jackson dollar.
Yeah.
I sadly agree. Although great outfits. His like purple Mr. Glass MG thing.
Yes.
Amazing.
His little sort of like diamond tie pin or whatever it is. Yes.
So good.
So let's wrap up and just kind of talking about like where or if this kind of fits into like kind of where we're at with like superhero movies in 2019, because it's, you know, as I was saying before, I mean, the terrain has just shifted so much. And one of the things that's so weird about this movie is it just, you know, it seems to take place in an alternate universe where that hasn't happened. Like Ellie Staple only ever mentions comic books as if that's the only way people would be. I'm sure there are people who've seen every Marvel movie who have never read a comic book at this point. Like, it's just not the main format in which the stuff is disseminated at any point. There is, I think you mentioned this in your review, Matt. I mean, he seems to be a character who keeps talking about when he's sort of meta-narrating and he's saying, well, we're in a limited edition. And then he says, oh, this isn't a limited edition. This is an origin story. But yeah, I think he's actually, I mean, this is a nerdy, like Trainspotter kind of point, but I think he's talking about a miniseries and not a limited edition, because that's not actually like a thing
right.
in comics.
Limited edition means how many copies.
Yes.
Yeah. Any comic book could be a limited edition.
Yes. Yeah. So it's just, if you're going to have like the nerdy geek character in there being like, well, actually, this is right. like he actually needs to get his stuff right. Like, you know, there's this title card at the beginning of Unbreakable that is like, the average comic book has 35 pages. And it's like, that's not true. Like, that wasn't true. That, like, I don't know where he got those numbers from, but that's like, the average comic book does not have 35 pages. That's not even, they come in multiples of four because their pages folded in, like, no average anything has 35 pages. That's not, like, it's just, what are you talking about?
Yeah. It is weird to have a character like explaining comics who doesn't seem to really fully understand how they work.
Yes.
And I guess, again, I'm trying really hard to like play devil's advocate. Like, maybe, well, he has been locked up in a mental hospital for a long time. Maybe he's kind of his mental state is not what it once was. He's kind of forgetting his the differences between limited editions and miniseries or whatever. But even like he says, oh, this is an origin story. What origin story ends with all three characters dying? Like, how often does that happen?
Yes, that was mysterious to me. And I felt like to truly make something like that work, there needed to be like a whole M. Night Shyamalan Avengers. We needed like at least two more splits. I guess he probably couldn't have pulled off the trick too many times. But there just wasn't enough characters for it either. Like, it does not gel.
Well, so he says that, this is it for him. He is done. I mean, I think we all stuck around to look for a post-credit scene because most superhero movies have them now. And it seemed like this movie might even, if only have to have a joke on that, it seemed like this one might have that. But there is nothing more. Shyamalan says he's done. Do we want him to be done? Is there any use to revisiting this, or does he just need to kind of find something new to do with his time at this point?
No, please just stick to, I mean, when he made The Visit, which was like a delightful low budget horror movie, he made a couple of, I think you mentioned it. It was just such a return to the kind of like weird gross out slash comedy slash like low key thriller thing that he's very good at. And that's what I would just love like five more of those from him. I don't see why he needs to escape so deeply into his mind, because nothing good comes when he does that.
Yeah, I think I would rather see him kind of return more like spiritually to like something like Unbreakable, where he deconstructed something and rather than have him sort of do something else in this world. I mean, he killed off all the main characters, so I'm not sure who he would even, I guess he could follow on Anya Taylor-Joy's character. Maybe she could turn out to be a superhero eventually in this world of superheroes. But I personally would have very little interest in seeing what happens in a world where people have put YouTube videos up and everyone's like, wow, I guess superheroes do exist. I saw it on YouTube.
Lord knows. Yes, everything on YouTube is true.
Right.
Therefore, it exists.
Yeah, I think I would just rather, I mean, like, I don't know. I would rather him actually surprise me. You know, like, he seems like he's trying so hard to surprise us here, and he telegraphs everything. Like, I mean, the fact that we didn't see anything of Dr. Staples' life outside that time, I was like, well, she's not on the level. Something's going on here. All of the otherwise unexplained shots of security cameras, I'm like, well, clearly we have to be paying attention to these security. Like, everything was telegraphed in a way that, like, and it's the fact that it starts with, like, an M. Night Shyamalan film. So you know what that he's going to try to surprise you somehow. It's like, I just, there was a time where he was this genuinely exciting, genuinely surprising filmmaker. And I don't know how he could get back to that, but I feel like that's the guy that I would rather see rather than any specific even genre or character that I would want to see him do more of. I would just rather try him, I don't know, be a little formally adventurous again and try something new and actually surprise me.
Yeah.
Yeah. For me, I'm kind of the best, the most concrete way to sort of just show like how sort of how much he's going to run out of gas and this sort of thing is when there's this like big final reveal at the end. They're like, oh, actually, Mr. Glass was taping them the whole time. And it's like, oh, my God, these cameras are everywhere. And then it cuts to these shots of people putting in the cameras. And they're the exact same shots that we saw earlier of people putting in the cameras that they went to like great lengths to tell us they were there. And it's like nobody has forgotten that there are security cameras like all over this asylum. Like you're not, it's like, oh my God, I forgot about that. Or I never thought that those cameras could record things that people could later see. It's like the cameras that we knew were there are doing the thing that we know cameras do. Like there's just nothing. It's, you know, it's not like going back to like the red doorknob in The Sixth Sense or something like that. Or like oh, that's why his wife wasn't talking to him.
Right.
There's nothing. Like nothing in this movie will look different the second time through.
No. And I mean, so much of it is just like random. Like even, I mean, we talked about so much about this Illuminati without talking about the fact that like this is the third movie. They just now mention like, oh, by the way, this whole time in three movies, there's been this evil anti-superhero Illuminati group that we never mentioned in any of the other movies. But they're here. They exist.
There's an extremely random quality to all the twists in this movie and really the whole proceedings. I think poor Shyamalan is sort of haunted by the next Spielberg, which is sort of like an infamous Newsweek cover that he was on back in like the Signs era. And like he has this need to prove over and over and over again. The quote from The Mastermind, which I feel like we have to say here, when they're supposedly talking about Samuel L. Jackson, but you see who they think they're really talking about here. He's too smart. He gets everyone looking in the wrong direction. That's why he's the mastermind. That's actual dialogue in the movie. And it's just so clearly that he's like kind of winking at what he does. And of course, he has a cameo in this movie. He has a cameo in all of his movies. And the extent to which this is about his ego just seems very, very high. And it's sad.
All right. On that happy note, Jeffrey Brillinger, Matt Singer, thank you for joining me for this spoiler special. You all enjoy Glass.